The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Supreme Court leaks a draft opinion overturning Roe v. Wade as voters in Ohio go to the polls in a test of President Trump's endorsement powers. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial board member Kate Batchelder-Odell. Kim, the big news yesterday, of course, is this leak for the Supreme Court, but we don't want to forget the news that's happening today, which is voters in Ohio going to the polls for the primary. Can you give us a little bit of a preview and the lay of the land of what to watch for tonight?
Sure. Actually, two big states go to the polls, Ohio and Indiana. And I'll just touch on a couple of races because all of these races are quite dramatic this year. This is something that happens whenever you have a census. And then state legislatures obviously rewrite the maps and it changes a bunch of districts, which means more competitive than usual primaries for a lot of districts. In Ohio, the big race to watch is the Senate race to fill the seat by retiring Republican Senator Rob Portman. Ohio's been trending right in recent years, so the winner of this primary is likely to be the next senator, which is why there's been a huge amount of interest, a very crowded field. This so far has been the most expensive Senate primary in the 2022 cycle, $70 million spent on both sides. But most eyes are on the GOP side, where you at the moment have a very close race between J.D. Vance, who was the author of Hillbilly Elegy and a venture capitalist, and has gotten some attention because Donald Trump endorsed him. He is running in a close race against State Senator Matt Dolan and former State Treasurer Josh Mandel, both of whom have been ticking up at the end in the polls. So in last look, J.D. Vance seemed to be ahead. He has a much more Trumpian kind of populist approach than the other two. And so this race is interesting just because it's going to say something about Donald Trump's mojo and how much his endorsement counts for something. Going over to Indiana, there's one House race that is worth watching. Indiana won, where there's a very crowded Republican primary to see who challenges freshman Democrat Frank Mervin. There are two veterans in the lead, Jennifer Ruth Green and Blair Milo. And what's kind of interesting about this particular race is it shows the GOP's new approach to elections in that those candidates are both women. They're both veterans. And in the case of Jennifer Ruth Green, also African-American. And the GOP has been working really hard in recent elections to try to get more diverse faces out there representing and bring in new voters. This was a district that Mervin actually won by 16 points in 2020, but Biden less than 10. And so that gives you a sense of the strength of their ambitions. And then finally, in Ohio, Ohio 11. This is a Cleveland district. Chantel Brown on the Democratic side, who is very much in the Biden camp, a little bit more moderate, won a 2021 special primary for the seat and then won the seat. She was challenged by Nina Turner, who is a progressive firebrand backed by Bernie Sanders. Turner's now back for a rematch. So again, this race sort of shows that ongoing Democratic divide and may say something about how the progressive movement is faring in this election cycle.
Just to dig in a little bit more on the Senate race, which is the one that a lot of people are watching, I'm going to check the polling data here at Real Clear Politics, the average, and it has J.D. Vance up with 26%. Josh Mandel with 22.5 and Matt Dolan with 21.5. And Vance and Mandel have both taken a pretty populist approach to this race. And Dolan is the guy who has come kind of out of nowhere in the last few days. And I've heard some talk that he's more of a traditional conservative, less of a MAGA conservative, and that maybe he's benefiting from the fact that Vance and Mandel have spent all this time attacking each other. But what's really notable here is that Trump has endorsed Vance, even though over the weekend at a rally, it was a little bit funny. He misspoke and he said he was rooting for J.D. Mandel. So that was a bit humorous. But the attacks in this race have been interesting. And there's a recent ad attacking this endorsement, essentially, of Vance from Club for Growth. Listen to this.
The elites were right about Donald Trump, right? I'm a never Trump guy.
Has Trump seen this?
President Trump tweeting a surprise endorsement of Mitt Romney for his run.
How'd that turn out?
Look, I love Trump, but he's getting it wrong with J.D. Vance, too.
I might have to vote for Hillary Clinton.
People who voted for Trump voted for him for racist reasons.
Where does he get off saying that?
We've got our own eyes and our own ears.
J.D. Vance is a fraud.
Club for Growth Action is responsible for the content of this ad.
So it's a little harder to make out without the video, but juxtaposing Vance's previous statements about Trump with his support now. And Kate, that's why people are watching this, because this is the first race that might suggest how Trump's endorsement will play in these other states where he's wading in, like Pennsylvania and Georgia.
Right, Kyle. We're going to see some more tests of those later this month. To your point about the polling as well, we see some really late surging. I mean, keep in mind that while Mandel has been in the teens to 20s for some time now, Vance really surged late from, no doubt, from this Trump endorsement, but was back at 10% or so even a month ago. So there is some late energy coming into this primary, which is to be expected, but it is still, I think, a pretty fluid race, and we could see some surprises over the polling tonight, depending on what happens. But I do think that the Club for Growth there has gone with a relatively potent line of attack that J.D. Vance has sort of reimagined his political career to be more affiliated with Trump, but he does have a long history of saying things that are not exactly flattering of the president. President Trump sort of wrote this off as, well, you know, everybody said something unflattering about me and I can't let that govern my endorsements, something to that effect. But I do think voters do start to wonder here whether Vance really is more aligned with Trump's politics or what exactly he's going to do in the Senate. There are some ways in which even Vance's new brand of populism is somewhat distinct from Trump's. I mean, we've seen a lively debate about the U.S. involvement in Ukraine, for instance, and Vance said early on that he didn't care one way or another what happened in Ukraine. He's since changed his tone a little bit, but Trump has been more carving out the territory of what happened in Ukraine would never have happened if I were president. So there are some modest differences there, and I will be interested to see what distinctions voters end up making.
I'm sure there'll be more to parse tomorrow once we get the returns in. But now on to the huge news that was breaking late Monday night. Politico reports that the Supreme Court, as of a couple months ago, had voted internally that it intended to strike down Roe v. Wade in this challenge, this case challenging a Mississippi abortion ban after 15 weeks. And they also published a draft opinion of the court by Justice Samuel Alito. It's dated February 10th. It's about 98 pages. And so, Kim, I guess to start, what do you make of this leak? What reason do we have to believe that this draft opinion is legit? And what do you make of it as a matter of law and legal reasoning?
Well, we do know it's legit now because the Supreme Court has issued a statement that suggests that it is. I mean, it basically refers to it as an authentic document. The court also condemned the leak, and John Roberts said that there was going to be an investigation conducted by the court martial into who did it. But, you know, even prior to that acknowledgement, it seemed pretty clear this did look like a legit document in that it's penned by Justice Alito. It was very much in his style. It also mirrored a lot of the arguments that you heard back in the oral argument period months ago, which had given many people a kind of hint or an indication that this is certainly where we were headed potentially with a decision. Now, we should point out that all that being said, this is a draft decision from February, and the justices do a lot of exchanging of opinions and drafts, and it's entirely possible that the votes or the wording votes for this decision in terms of the justices who sign on or the wording of the decision could certainly change before it's actually issued.
Yeah, I think that's worth underlining, although it is interesting to imagine who could have leaked this and for what reason. And if the intent was, if this is somebody, you know, a court staffer, somebody who works in administration at the court, and the intent was to build a political firestorm and convince one of these justices who had planned to overrule Roe to have second thoughts, I wonder if that might backfire, Kate, because if there were five votes to overrule Roe v. Wade in February, and that's now public information. I think it makes it harder for one of the justices who might be having second thoughts to back away now. It would look like the leak, you know, the political intimidation or what have you, the debate that has gone on after it, was what moved the justice instead of the justice actually changing his mind.
I agree, Kyle. I think it raises the costs of them changing the substance of the opinion at this juncture. And I think we do not know the motivation of the leaker or the source of the leak, and I think that's worth bearing in mind. I mean, before we get into the substance of the law, I do think it's just regrettable that this happened. As you know from covering the court closely, the Supreme Court is kind of this rare enclave of American life where passionate disagreement and collegiality can coexist. And I think it's really damaging to the institution for someone to leak an opinion that's still under draft and was being circulated and debated inside the court. For the listeners who haven't read Kyle's interview with Neil Gorsuch from several years ago, you read about things like welcoming new justices to the court by racing Nationals mascots down the hall and other kind of collegial spirited traditions that make the court function as a friendly institution with their colleagues. So I think this could really damage that and that the public will miss that when it's gone. But I also think to that point, Kyle, we don't know who leaked it and we don't know who may have access to this draft opinion or what their motivations might be. So while it's possible that it was, I think there's an easy narrative that perhaps it is a person who wants to start a political firestorm before it is released and persuade the justices to back off. I think that's the most plausible narrative. The truth is that we don't know, and we don't know what effect this will have. I think John Roberts was right to say in his statement released this afternoon that this is a draft opinion, and if the goal was to intimidate the court, that will not succeed. I think that was an important statement from him, and hopefully it is an accurate one.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I will just read a piece of the statement from the Chief Justice John Roberts here, and this is from a tweet from Supreme Court reporter Shannon Bream. The Chief Justice says, "To the extent this betrayal of the confidences of the court was intended to undermine the integrity of our operations, it will not succeed. The work of the court will not be affected in any way. We at the court are blessed to have a workforce, permanent employees and law clerks alike, intensely loyal to the institution and dedicated to the rule of law." He also adds that he's asked the marshal of the court to launch an investigation into the source of the leak. Kim, how seriously do you take that investigation? Do you think that it's easy or difficult to find a leaker in a situation like this? Or at the very least, it seems to me they should be looking at their security procedures and how many employees have access to these pre-decision documents.
Yeah, well, one thing to note that really jumped out in the portion of that statement you just read is he said, "We are blessed to have a workforce, permanent employees and law clerks alike." And again, he later mentions the employees of the court. Now, this matters, at least in my mind, in that one of the obvious first questions that would come to mind was, is it possible that one of the justices themselves leaked it? This would seem to suggest absolutely not. One has to assume that the Chief Justice has either talked to them about that or maintains the confidence that they were not part of it, and that this is either a law clerk or an employee. That's interesting in that regard. We have had prior leaks, nothing to this extent. There's never been a draft opinion published before. So it is a kind of unforgivable offense. And I would note that unlike a lot of leaks that you get in the larger federal bureaucracy, in particular in the executive branch or even in Congress, there is a much smaller universe of people that you can look at here, in that most of the justices, for instance, are entitled to have up to 4 law clerks apiece. I think the Chief Justice can have up to 5, although I don't think he's exercised that recently. So a pretty small universe. You can also assume that it probably wasn't a law clerk from anyone on the conservative justices' side that agree with this opinion. Or, I mean, that's a little bit of a leap, but it's a little common sense. And yes, there's some employees there, but I don't think it's a giant universe of people. So in that regard, a leak investigation might be a bit easier. You also have to assume this was probably laundered, however, through X number many of people before it ended up at Politico. But it should be, in theory, possible. And it is good just to see that they're doing it, because it sends a message. What you don't want to have happen here is for this to become routine, and for those who engage in such a practice to think that they can do it with no ramifications.
I would make two points about the opinion as a matter of law and legal argument. One, Kate, is that it seems to me that it aims for finality of this question, at least at the federal Supreme Court level. I've seen a couple commentators say that they knew that a decision in this Mississippi case was coming down, but they expected something to have a lighter touch, to be less of a broadside. And, I mean, who knows how this opinion, which, again, this draft is dated February, so who knows how it might have been edited in the meantime. But I think what Justice Alito is trying to avoid is a situation where the court takes a soft touch, and then in 10 or 15 years, it is being asked this question again. That's why you have this appendix where Alito goes through all these laws in the 1800s where states had banned or punished abortion. I think that's what he's trying to do there. The other is this paragraph where he says that opponents of this decision will say that it threatens other court decisions that protect things like gay marriage or access to contraception. And what Alito says explicitly is there's a different issue here that involves fetal life. And so it rises to a level where those previous decisions do not, and this decision does not threaten those prior precedents. And I think that's important for him to say.
Yeah, Kyle, I mean, when we talk about settling the question here, the question we're talking about is not what restrictions should be placed on abortion in America, but who should decide what those restrictions are. And what the Alito draft opinion is suggesting is that this debate should be returned to the normal political process. And he talks in great detail about how what Roe did was create a set of conditions about abortion restrictions that looked really similar to what legislators might do if they were passing their preferred policy for abortion in the United States and how it's regulated. So what this opinion aims to do is to return that question to voters. It is not to supersede that. And Alito makes direct mention of that on several occasions. And he talks specifically about how Roe invented a viability test and how Casey, the case that came many years later, invented an undue burden test about whether a restriction was an undue burden on a woman's ability to seek an abortion, and how these tests were not tenable as a matter of constitutional law or as in practice for lower courts to sort out what exactly met the test and didn't. For instance, on the viability standard, he talks extensively about how viability is not a clear and cut line. It is a judgment that rests on several factors, such as the available medical care for the child. And it has also, the viability line of a pregnancy has moved substantially since Roe was decided. When Roe was decided in the 1970s, it was closer to 28 weeks. And now we see hospitals make routine interventions for babies born at 23 to 24 weeks. And so this line is just not rooted in law or practice, and it does invite the court to weigh in on these questions that it's not suited to resolve and doesn't have the authority to resolve. So what Alito does here is walk through why Roe was untenable, why it was, as it was called at the time in the dissent, an exercise of raw judicial power. He goes on to quote a number of legal scholars who question the constitutional underpinnings of the decision across the legal spectrum, even those who support, as a matter of policy, a woman's ability to seek an abortion. So I think it's really important to talk about what this opinion would do if it is finalized and handed down, and it has not been yet, is to return this question to the voters and to get the court out of these really untenable standards and tests for deciding what restrictions are that have just not only not settled the issue over the past 50 years, but really inflamed it further and precluded a honest political debate that allows persuasion and allows the people who lose at the ballot box an honest defeat and those who prevail in persuading their fellow citizens an honest victory.
But if the effect of overturning Roe would be to return the issue of abortion back to the voters, what do we think the voters will say? And we all know we're in the middle of a midterm election right now. As it happens, before this leak, we got an email from a reader, Ian in Texas, who was asking about this anyway. He says, the effect of the Supreme Court overturning Roe, if it happens, I could easily see a scenario where Democrats run on packing the courts to ostensibly protect the U.S. from becoming the Handmaid's Tale 2.0. He also suggests, Kim, that it could completely scramble the calculus for the GOP retaking the House and the Senate. Kim, what do you make of that?
Well, I guess a couple of things. There's two questions here. One, which you began to touch on, which is where does this actually head in terms of state fights and where legislatures fall on this. And it was interesting, one of the things Alito said in this draft argument is that rooting in favor of changing this is the fact that as a country, there are still wildly different views on this and that states' populations lean in different directions on this, which was an argument for returning this to the political process. And those fights are going to be obviously waged in those state legislatures if this opinion stands in the end. In terms of the midterms, that's a different question. And I've been struck. I mean, not surprisingly, those on the left, Democrats, immediately adopted the most extreme outrage and predicted that the sky would fall, the world would end. While I don't doubt that they do care about this, some on the substance, I also don't quite buy into the notion that even they think this is as apocalyptic, because everybody, kind of reasonable people, understand that norms in the country have changed a lot over the years, and significant numbers of states are still going to come out on the side of allowing abortions. It was interesting to see even Elizabeth Warren noting in a tweet, she said, wealthy women are not going to have any problem getting an abortion. They can just go to another state. But she said the problem would be women of color and those lower incomes. So that's, you know, a progressive acknowledging that it's still going to be available in this country in some geography, regardless of this opinion. I think more interesting is what Democrats are trying to do with the politics, which gets to our listeners' question. And yeah, they're going to use this for all it's worth. They've got a lackluster Democratic base at the moment. They're going to hope that this rejuvenates them and gets them to the polls. I think you're going to have some return of enthusiasm among progressive activists who have otherwise been a bit disappointed in the Biden agenda, but this is something for them to sink their teeth into. This may play most profoundly at state levels, like at the governor level, because of the new potentiality for states to be front and center in this. But I would also say on the other side, this might also activate Republican voters, because remember, conservative voters have long cared more about court politics. It's been an issue that has historically driven more conservatives to the polls than Democrats. If this opinion stands, I think that's going to be salutary for a lot of Republicans and see that as a reason to remain engaged because of the achievements that they are getting from some on the court. It's going to be a real muddle. Opinions on this vary. There's questions of suburban voters. How will that play? It certainly has injected a new element.
And what I would add to that, I guess, is I think it also depends on how Republicans and Democrats each react to this, what their response is to this, because public opinion is really mixed. There's a recent Wall Street Journal poll this month, and if the question is, do you favor a ban on abortion with exceptions for health of the mother after 15 weeks, which is the Mississippi law at issue in the Supreme Court case, 48% favor that, and 43% oppose that. But if you move the dividing line and you say, how about after 6 weeks, then it flips. You have 42% who favor it after 6 weeks and 50% who oppose it after 6 weeks. And neither side is satisfied with that muddle, whether as a matter of morality or religion or philosophy. But Kate, that's just reading the opinion polls. That's just what they say. And so there may be instances where Republicans are asked the harder questions about exceptions for rape or incest, and they say clumsy, unpopular things running in some of these swing states, and vice versa. Here's a recent clip we have of Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania, John Fetterman, asked if he would support any limits on abortion. This is in a recent debate because Fetterman is running for the Democratic nomination for Senate in Pennsylvania.
Are there any limits on abortion you would find appropriate?
I don't believe so, no. I believe that is between a woman and her physician, and it's certainly not between me or any politician. We settled this decades ago, and the fact that these states are trying to repeal it, it's just we have to push back against that because it started in Texas. I'm proud to say that if I am voting on a Supreme Court justice, that is a core litmus test that Roe v. Wade and the sanctity of women's reproductive freedom must always come first. It's non-negotiable.
So, Kate, no limits on abortion. That's what John Fetterman says. I'm not sure that that is a winning political position either. And that's to say nothing of if you are going to call for killing the filibuster and packing the Supreme Court to get there.
I agree, Kyle. I mean, to your point, public opinion on this is somewhat mixed. And I agree with Kim, too, that I think it will cut both ways. I don't think it's good news for the Democrats that this is the issue they're going to have to rely on to turn out their base, because I do think the public is not generally in favor of the Fetterman position that he just described, which is that there are really no acceptable restrictions on abortion. And I also think that most abortion polling suggests that even the public, that part of the public that supports abortion up to a certain point, generally don't see it as a desirable social good, but maybe just a sad reality or something that they think is better than the alternative of outlawing it. So the Democratic energy on abortion could cut both ways and help some candidates in some places, but also harm some. But I think to your point about how muddled the politics of this are and how the polling seems to show different things, especially when you ask different questions about whether Roe should be overturned or whether you favor bans at 15 weeks or 6 weeks, I think a lot of what we should take from those polls is that voters have not had to debate these questions in some time because they have been somewhat academic given the Supreme Court jurisprudence. So even on the Republican side, we're seeing Republicans, such as in Texas, pass these bills that ban abortion very early and allow for very few exceptions. But they haven't really had to grapple with the public's view of that bill because of the Supreme Court prevailing opinion. So now we're going to have these debates that are much messier and really require candidates to answer what dispensations are appropriate, what timeline is appropriate, and who benefits from that, I think is still an open question. And I think it'll be a mix of both, depending on how thoughtful Republicans are in engaging in this issue, to your point. But I do think it would be more healthy for the country to have that debate in the political forum than the current environment we have now that is just extremely dug in on both sides and divided by this prevailing court opinion.
Thank you, Kate and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.